there's danger everywhere. But danger had never looked quite like this before.
Can you keep a secret?
Based on shocking true events.
This girl, Rena Virk, she's been missing for 3 days.
Emmy Award nominee Riley Keough.
Young girls were the ones we were supposed to protect.
Academy Award nominee Lily Gladstone.
Can't be.
Not be protected from.
A Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays only on Hulu.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
Hey, everybody, this is Joe. I've got a new podcast project for you that I'm doing with my friend Vincent. Alas, there's no Steve, no Devin, so this is not Thinking Sideways. It's a new podcast called The Shocking Details. Check out our website at www.theshockingdetails.com. And, of course, we're on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and everywhere else. But I wanted to say this. We were messing around with some different audio gear for this one. And the sound quality isn't quite the best, but rest assured, in the future, episodes will sound a lot better. So, enjoy.
Featuring Joe from Thinking Sideways Podcast and filmmaker Vincent Caldelli, this is The Shocking Details.
Yes, that is correct, Joe. I'm here on the banks of the Puget Sound, where a mystery is unfolding tonight. After an emergency beachside landing, software impresario and Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates has been reported missing, and things only get stranger from there. Apparently, Mr. Gates was aboard his Learjet returning from a conference in British Columbia, surrounded by business associates, when he excused himself to use the plane's restroom. A few minutes later, his personal assistant went to check on him and found that he was not in the washroom at the back of the airplane. Nor was he anywhere aboard the craft. A massive search is underway at this time, but as speculations and rumors swirl, authorities admit they are no closer to locating the billionaire's whereabouts.
So imagine that one day you pick up the paper and it tells you that somebody really rich and famous has just disappeared. Say Bill Gates. And by the way, Bill Gates didn't just disappear while he was on his way to the Quickie Mart for a pack of smokes like most people do. No, he actually vanished, as you heard, from his corporate Learjet in mid-flight, and nobody else in the plane even saw it or heard it happen.
I mean, that sounds impossible.
It sure does, but something like this actually did happen. Somebody vanished from his corporate jet about 90 years ago.
Alfred Lowenstein was one of the richest guys in the world at this time, and he had to relieve himself. And this is 1928. He rises from his seat, and he walked back to the back of the plane where the restroom was housed. And he passes his business associate, Arthur Hodges. He saw him lumber toward the back to the rear of the craft, the English Channel shooting by underneath him, his secretaries and his loyal valet, Fred Baxter. They all see him. They all see him go. But just like that, Alfred Lowenstein, financier, innovator, philanthropist, and one very rich fellow is gone.
Just like that. Vamanos.
And this was on a warm July night in 1928.
over the English Channel. When he didn't return after 10 or 15 minutes, Mr. Baxter, the valet, went to check on his employer, Mr. Lowenstein. He found that the head was empty. There was quite literally not any sign of Lowenstein aboard this plane, which was a Fokker 7 tri-motor. Not a very huge plane, frankly. Baxter made his way to the cockpit and handed a note to the pilot telling him that Mr. Lowenstein had disappeared. Yes, the impossible had happened. He had vanished somehow off of a plane.
So let's back up. Who vanished? Who was Alfred Lowenstein? What in his biography could have left so many theories in the wake of his vanishing?
Well, Mr. Lowenstein was born in Brussels in 1877. By 1914, he had established a successful bank and made extensive investments in electric power and artificial silk, which were two new and very growing industries at that time. In 1926, he founded International Holdings and Investments Limited, which was kind of almost a venture capital company. It raised large amounts of money from investors who wanted to climb on board the Lowenstein money-making train. So at the time of his death, Lowenstein was one of the richest men in the world.
In 1908, he married Madeleine Masson, who was from a prominent Belgian family. She was beautiful, elegant, sophisticated, but reportedly not very warm or emotional. And the marriage wasn't passionate. But Alfred and Madeleine made the most of their arrangement. For Alfred, a trophy wife and a male heir, and for Madeleine, stability and, you know, more money than she could have ever dreamt of.
Lots and lots of money.
Doesn't hurt. May not have been the stuff of romance novels, but I don't think either had much to complain about.
No, reportedly they actually got along quite well.
Yeah.
But back to our plane ride, when Mr. Baxter, the valet, looked in the head, as I said, Lowenstein wasn't there, which was strange. There's nowhere else he could have been. I mean, the plane is essentially divided into four sections, a cockpit, passenger compartment, the head, which is also where the entrance to the plane is, the entry door. And beyond that, the cargo area, which cannot be accessed from inside the plane. So there was literally nowhere he could have gone. And so when Baxter found the empty head, he went forward, as I said, and handed a note to the pilot, Donald Drew, saying he had disappeared.
Now, at this point, the aircraft is still over the English Channel, about 5 miles north of Dunkirk, France. There remains speculation as to exactly why Drew chose to land the plane on a beach versus putting it down at the nearest airfield. If he explained himself when it happened, that explanation has been lost to time.
Now, the beach at this time was under the control of the French military. And they, of course, when they noticed a strange airplane sitting down on their beach, they went out there with some questions. When they were apprised of what had happened, they instructed the crew to fly to the nearest airfield and phone the police. And when they did this, they offered a fairly simple explanation for what they thought had happened. The pilot and the co-pilot both told the police that the exit door of the airplane opened fairly easily and that they believed that perhaps Alfred Lowenstein had bumped against the door. The door flew open and Lowenstein fell out of the plane.
They eventually recovered the body after about 3 weeks, and it only led to more questions than answers. And it was an unrecognizable corpse, badly decomposed. Fishermen found it, and when they found him, he was wearing Lowenstein's watch.
Lowenstein.
Lowenstein's watch.
That gets me too.
His silk underwear, his socks and his shoes, and the rest of his clothes he was wearing were never found. Lowenstein was wearing shoes, but then somehow his pants came off.
That's an odd one. I don't quite get that one. Maybe the fisherman took the pants. I don't know. But a private autopsy was done at the request of Lowenstein's wife, Madeleine. He was found to have a cracked skull and several broken bones, which is not inconsistent with a long 4,000-foot fall into the English Channel from an airplane. Doctors concluded that he had died from the fall, and otherwise they found nothing abnormal. There was no poison in his system. He had no big medical issues. There was no indication of foul play, no defensive wounds.
Madeleine had Alfred buried in her family cemetery in an unmarked grave. She also declined to attend his funeral. But the case, it wound down eventually in the press. Eventually, curiosity about his death was minimal from officials, to say the least, part of which being that he died outside of any official jurisdiction.
That's right. He was over the English Channel.
And with that, he was gone again.
So, another mystery for us to solve. There's various theories. It could have been suicide. It could have been an accidental death, as the pilot and co-pilot thought. And some people even thought perhaps murder. And there was even some discussion of perhaps an Orient Express sort of murder scenario where everybody on the plane took part in the killing.
I like the theory that maybe he tried to disappear.
It could be that. Maybe he faked his own death so he could skip town. Yeah. That's a viable theory also. But go back to the beginning here. Let's go. I'll bring you in on a few more details here.
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah. It was July 4th, 1928. Lowenstein and his entourage left the Croydon Airfield in the south of London. It was apparently the number one aerodrome
in England at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they take off about 6:30 p.m. And the plan was to fly to Brussels, about 200 miles east, on Lowenstein's private airplane. As you informed us, that's a Belgian-made Fokker 7 trimotor.
Yeah. A fun little plane that was capable of cruising at a breathtaking 106 miles an hour. So this should have been about a two-hour flight, assuming no headwinds or anything like that. The weather was good. Sunset at Dunkirk was about 9:07 p.m., so it was a daylight flight.
So let's also talk about who's on there.
Yeah.
The suspects.
Our possible murder suspects or witnesses, so
there were six people on the plane. There was Donald Drew, who was the pilot. Robert Little, who was a co-pilot and mechanic. Fred Baxter, that was Lowenstein's valet. Arthur Hodgson, who was a secretary and business associate. Eileen Clark, who was a stenographer. And Paula Bidelon, who was also a stenographer, correct?
Yeah, also. Lowenstein liked to travel with a couple of stenographers because he was a very, very energetic, busy guy. And he was constantly dictating memos and letters. And so having two stenographers there to bounce back and forth between them apparently was his just standard way of doing business.
Wow.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons he got so rich, is the guy was just so energetic. But it should be noted that by this point in his life, he had developed a few health problems. He was a workaholic and a stressful job. He had apparently very high blood pressure. And he had some recent lapses, which may have been related to the stress and perhaps the high blood pressure. He had some absent-mindedness, which included one incident where he nearly walked into the propeller of his plane. That would be the Fokker 7 trimotor. Nearly walked into it.
That would maybe lead to the theoretical explanation that it could be an accident, that he just sort of Mr. Magooed out the back of the plane.
Yeah, he could have like mistaken the door of the head for the exit door of the plane.
And it would have been dark at this time?
No, it would have been light still. Okay. But I don't know how light it was inside that airplane.
Yeah.
Of course, and that has been proposed as a theory, is that perhaps he mistook one door for the other. But I have a problem with that.
Okay.
Which is this. The way it worked is the same way. They didn't have a separate door. There was a door between the passenger compartment and the little compartment in the back that had the entry foyer and that had the head. Mm-hmm. And there was a door between that. And that door doubled as the door to the head. Mm-hmm. So when that door was open, then the head was closed. And when that door and people are boarding and deboarding the plane. Mm-hmm. And in flight, if you needed to use the head, then you just went back and shut that door between the main cabin and that little foyer, mm-hmm. and use the head. The head at that point has no door on it. It's open. So mm-hmm. if you walk back into that little foyer and close the door between it and the main passenger cabin, then there was no chance of mistaking the head door for the exit door.
Yeah.
Because the head would have no door on it. He could look in there and see a toilet.
Yeah. Well, and then also the police attempted to open the door mid-flight on a similar aircraft.
Well, yeah.
They couldn't do it.
Yeah, they tried at cruising speed, which I said is about 106 miles an hour, and they tried to force the door open, and they found that, well, it didn't want to open. I mean, just try opening your car door. It's on the freeway at 60 miles an hour and see what, you know, it's not easy, right?
It makes sense. It actually makes perfect sense.
Imagine it nearly double the speed. So the whole idea that he fell out of the plane seems a little silly to me.
Now, refresh my memory. When the plane landed, did they find this door open or closed?
Closed.
It was closed. It was shut.
Yeah, it's nothing seriously wrong. There was one theory that one person put out is that perhaps the pilot and the co-pilot had conspired to murder Lowenstein, and they mm-hmm. placed a door that was faulty, that didn't latch correctly, on the in the entry to the plane, landed on the beach so that one of them could hop out of the plane and pull that door off the plane and then swap it with the door to the luggage compartment, which was an identical size door and which worked correctly. And that's one thing. I find that a little hard to believe, because even if the door didn't latch correctly, it still would not have come open easily.
Okay, so now we're getting into murder. If these guys wanted to kill him, why would they do that? Why would the pilot kill him?
Well, I know. And, well, for one thing, of course, you know, being a highly successful millionaire, he's obviously screwed some people in the past. And so he had a few enemies in that respect. It could have been a hit. That somebody paid the pilot and the co-pilot to murder him is a possibility. And the possibilities of suicide and murder kind of mixed together here, because in spring and summer 1928, an anonymous document was being circulated in financial circles in Europe, which accused Lowenstein of quite a few financial crimes in the course of building his little empire. Mm-hmm. And this actually caused a big hit on his holding company's stock. It did plummet. And so on paper, at least, his fortune did actually go down quite a bit. And people involved in business dealings with Lowenstein began to see him as a liability. Papers reported he'd been turned down for $1 million loan. So apparently he was maybe a little hard up for walking around cash. And so is it possible that his financial empire was about to fall apart and the pressure got to be too much? This would explain the suicide thing. But also, he had business partners in his holding company. Mm-hmm. This is where murder comes in. If they saw him as more of a liability than an asset at this point in time, then perhaps they thought they should just get him out of the way, and then they could just say, well, he's gone, no harm, no foul, let's go back to business as usual.
I mean, I think from, pardon the bad pun, 30,000 feet, that looks good. But
yeah,
when you really start thinking about it, I don't know that holds up.
Murder
or suicide. If it's suicide, how's he get out of the plane? They tried to open the door and couldn't do it.
That's it. Yeah, he was in his 50s. I'm not sure what kind of shape he was in, but it would have been pretty difficult to force the door open far enough to get out of the plane.
Right.
I mean, maybe he could have somehow forced it and squeezed through it. And I don't know. Maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And then in terms of murder, there has to be. I mean, Joe, there has to be an easier way to kill a guy than in a tiny space with six witnesses or four other witnesses, whoever was involved.
Yeah. Well, there's got to be. I mean, I would think there's poisoning or maybe run them over with a car. I mean, there's all kinds of ways to kill somebody.
Right. And make it look like a random mugging on the streets of London.
Yeah.
It's just not a very elegant way to go about a murder.
Oh, I know. But there is one guy who's actually probably more than anybody else researched this case. And that the guy's name is William Norris, and he wrote a book called The Man Who Fell from the Sky, which was published in 1987. And he is the foremost proponent of the murder theory. He believes that pilot Drew and co-pilot Little were hired by Lowenstein's business partners to kill him. Some other possible suspects might include his wife or some of his enemies, as I said. I don't think that his wife really is a viable suspect personally. So why his partners wanted to kill him? As I already mentioned, there was that anonymous document that was making the rounds. So they wanted to perhaps avoid being dragged under by him if he did wind up going down for a bunch of financial crimes, which seems like a reasonable motive. Again, there's easier ways to do this.
I was gonna say.
Yeah, and of course, you know, in a sense, the other problem I have with this theory is that when the word came that Lowenstein had disappeared, when that hit the news, the stocks in his company dropped quite a bit. So these guys actually lost money. His partners lost money when he disappeared.
Yeah, and then when if you were to kill Elon Musk,
what happens to SpaceX?
Exactly. Yeah. That stock would probably fall. It would be a great money making proposition.
Indubitably, it would fall. Did I just say indubitably? Oh, my God. I think they really would have done more damage to themselves by killing him. But again, I don't know how strong the case for financial malfeasance was against Lowenstein either.
Yeah. Do we have any idea who distributed this document, this anonymous document?
I think the name eventually did come out. And I think I messed up and didn't note it in my notes here. Damn it.
But
it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. I think we know who it was. Would they be considered a suspect?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I think that if you really want to murder him, if you got that big of a grudge against him, maybe this is just me and my mindset. I would be thinking I wouldn't telegraph my motive to everybody by penning this anonymous letter and then killing him. When, by the way, when eventually your name is going to be linked to the letter, and you'll be a prime suspect.
Maybe the idea was to knock him out of his position of power with the letter, and when that failed, they crafted the plot.
That could have been it. Yeah, I suppose so. Or maybe the idea was to just like blacken his name enough so that when he disappeared, people would, instead of being shocked and dismayed, would just be kind of relieved. Right. Maybe that was the idea. I don't know.
All of these plans are so elaborate.
They are. It is rather elaborate. But William Norris, the author, did some extensive research, as I said. He did find that both Drew, the pilot, and Little, the co-pilot, after that flight, lived well beyond their means for quite a long time. And as for the valet, the secretary, and the stenographers, well, if they didn't participate in the murder, they must have been at least paid off and under this theory, or maybe made to disappear. And actually, Arthur Hodgson, the secretary, and the two stenographers actually do vanish from history after this point.
That's interesting.
So maybe they were murdered, done away with.
Murdered.
Baxter.
Pretty easy to lose somebody in 1926, though.
But Mr. Baxter, the valet, on the other hand, did not vanish. He was hired by Lowenstein's son, Bobby Lowenstein. But he did die several years later, about 4 years later, I think, from an apparently self-inflicted gunshot wound. Yeah. Well, made with Bobby Lowenstein's revolver, by the way.
It's also sketchy. I mean, this is so, it's so weird how, like, there's people disappearing and suicides.
Yeah,
it does seem like there's something to it.
There is something sketchy about this. Somebody vanishes. And the suicide, of course, was years later. One of the theories that I have, and I may be jumping ahead of myself here, is that if you're thinking that perhaps Baxter the valet was murdered and made to look like a suicide, maybe he found out something he wasn't supposed to know. Maybe he found out that Lowenstein had disappeared, was living somewhere else under a different name. And once he found that out, he had to be gotten rid of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know.
I mean, so if we're going to get on to that theory, I favor, in general, much more pedestrian explanations of things like this.
Yeah, me too.
But in this case, the thing that kind of makes the most sense is that he pays off the people on the airplane, lands the airplane in France, as you would say, beats feet out of there.
Yeah.
The police come. They say, we lost him.
Yeah. And he fell out of the plane.
Yep. Yeah. He's in a car headed for Belgium, headed for Russia, headed for wherever he wants to go.
He could have even actually, he could have even not told most of the people on the plane. He could have just told the pilot, say, here's what I'm going to do, and I'm going to pay you off. Or maybe he told both pilot and co-pilot, and he paid them off handsomely and said, look, you know, I'm going to go in the back and well, actually thinking about it, let me think here. So I have had this thought that perhaps he hadn't had that plane that long.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps he bought it for a reason. And that is that from the head or from the 48 compartment, perhaps he could have installed a hidden door.
Mm-hmm.
So if he wants to fake his own disappearance and death, so he's got his plane all prepped and everything. He goes back. He's already clued the pilot in. He said, land me on this beach. And then he goes to the head, but goes and hides with the luggage instead. And as soon as he touches down on the beach, then
he heads out the luggage
compartment door and lays flat. And the pilot, of course, under instructions, you know, moseys down the beach a ways, taxis down the beach. And then Lowenstein picks himself up and walks across the beach. At this point, he's far enough in the rearview mirror. Mm-hmm. He just looks like some random dude walking down the beach.
Yeah.
So he walks across the beach, and there's a road right there off the beach where he's got, perhaps, hypothetically, somebody waiting in a car to pick him up.
I think what's challenging about the disappearance, all the disappearance theories for me, is that we don't know enough about Lowenstein's finances.
We don't,
You know, did he have some money squirreled away? Did he have $1 million in a Swiss bank account that we don't know about?
Well, you know, this is, again, me and my mindset. If I were, say, anybody stinking rich, like, say, if I were Bill Gates or anybody, I would have, say, $5-10 million in just cash, you know, just squirreled away in various hiding places. I would have some gold. I would have all kinds of stuff. I wouldn't have all my money just in stocks and bonds and things like that. I'd want to have some cold, hard cash.
Well, and in the 1920s, this is the era of bearer bonds, of extremely large currencies.
Yeah.
He could be in, we know that he was invested in a lot of different businesses.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the one of all the ones that we've come across. And that's why I think there's actually an entertaining case for me is that I would say, oh, it probably was just an accident. But it kind of is the one that makes the best sense, especially since they didn't land on an airfield. Yeah. That's really what keyed me in on it. We're talking about this. They land on the beach. Why do they land on the beach?
Well, yeah, there's a few things about that we should to take a look at
here. Yeah, let's dig into the beach. Because that kind of flipped my whole thinking on it. Pilot, the co-pilot, told the police that the door opened easily.
Yeah.
They should know that when that airstream is pushing on the door, it's not going to open easily. If they're pilots.
So let's look at all the evidence. Consider this. The pilot, Donald Drew, puts the plane down on a deserted beach.
Drew and Little both told the police that the door on the airplane opened easily, and that was not true.
Exactly. And both Drew and Little appeared to have lived beyond their means after the disappearance.
The incident took place over the English Channel, outside of the jurisdiction of any estate.
Yeah. And of course, as I said, the Fokker trimotor belonged to Lowenstein, so he had control over it and he could have modified it.
Compartment to hide in, a hatch to escape from.
Yeah, exactly. So considering all those things, I say we got the suicide, the murder, and the murder again, I just find that too hard to believe. And I typically, in cases like this, I usually go for something other than he arranged his own disappearance. But in this case, I don't know. I got to say, I kind of like the disappearing theory, like you said.
We're kind of on the same page.
And there's another possibility, which is that maybe he didn't even get on the plane to begin with. And while everybody's like looking over the English Channel for him, you know, or
right.
And if anybody suspected something, let's say, you know, somebody sharp minded like you and I suspected that he faked the whole thing and he'd actually gotten off at Dunkirk and, mm-hmm. and gone away and they were looking for him there. He's actually already on a plane heading to, say, America.
Uh-huh.
And he was never even over the English Channel to begin with.
Yeah.
So that's another possibility.
I think it's a really interesting possibility.
Yeah.
The other thing that really caught my eye was that his wife buried him in an unmarked grave.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it?
I mean, because I know that forensics were probably pretty young back then.
But, oh, yeah.
You know, the ultimate thing would be to dig him up. I mean, even today, we could probably get some amount of DNA or dental records or something to see if that body was really his. Putting him in an unmarked grave increases the likelihood that corpse gets lost.
Yeah, there's that. Also, it was built. It was actually buried in the Masson family graveyard. It was a private graveyard. Mm-hmm. So I don't know exactly what the logistics, legally speaking. I assume you can still get a court order to have something exhumed. But if it's on private property like that, it might be a little harder.
Well, but then you could come up with the thing that if you did get the court order or whatever, it all comes through, that the records are incorrect. The records have been lost.
Right.
The records were intentionally obfuscated so that it would be harder to dig that body up. I mean, how many rich men are buried in unmarked graves?
Yeah, not that many.
Very common.
Yeah, I know. It's an intriguing thing. And but if his body could be found, it would be worthwhile, I think, to actually do a little, run a little DNA against him. And I assume it's known where his son, Bobby, who has to be dead by now, I assume it is known where Bobby is buried. So let's dig up the bodies and see if they're a match.
Oh, I mean, I'm sure there's probably still a Lowenstein bloodline out there somewhere there's
probably somebody still alive. Might not even have to dig Bobby up, right?
Yeah. What else? Are there any other theories, or is this kind of, or have we settled on this? Because I'm the more we talk about it, I'm sold on the self-disappearance.
Yeah, I'm kind of sold on that too. I think he decided to, it may well be, you know, he said when this so-called anonymous document came out, accusing him of all sorts of crimes, it was just all pure libel, perhaps. But it might have been enough truth there that perhaps he was concerned about perhaps an indictment or two and thought, well, maybe it's time to just get out of town.
Yeah.
And that might be another way of, you know, I don't know what financial regulation was like in 1928.
It was terrible.
Yeah, it might.
I don't know that much.
Yeah, but it might well be that he sort of knew that if he left, then the feds would not step in and dismantle his companies or penalize his partners or his family or any of that stuff if he just died.
Uh-huh.
They would just drop the whole matter.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And that is what happened.
And so essentially, by disappearing and quote unquote dying, then perhaps he escaped not just indictment himself and maybe imprisonment, but also the destruction of his companies, which were kind of key to his partner's well-being and his family's well-being. So perhaps he just thought, I'll just go off and live on a little island somewhere on the several million bucks that I've got squirreled away in this Swiss bank account. you know?
Which then means, you know, somewhere out there, there's a grave from, you know, 1945 or 55 of a man living under an assumed name.
Yeah.
Someplace.
Yeah. He lived under an assumed name, probably got himself a new girl and fathered another kid, you know, because who knows? I mean, yeah. So if you're out there and you are the unacknowledged descendant of Mr. Lowenstein, we want to hear from you.
Yeah, we'll put you on the podcast. We'll do an interview.
Yeah, we totally will. We'll do a little follow-up episode here.
And if you're out there, Mr. Lowenstein, and happen to still be alive for some reason, we'd welcome you as a podcast guest.
We totally would.
I think that probably wraps it up.
If you'd like to get a hold of us, you can send us an email at theshockingdetailspodcast@gmail.com. You can also check out our website. That's www.theshockingdetails.com. We're on Twitter. That would be @ShockingDetails. And, of course, we're also on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/groups/ShockingDetailsPodcast. Until next week, toodaloo.